America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. I'm sure there's some teachers in our audience, and I want to echo what Ruth and Janice had to say about one excellent teacher is all it takes to change the course of your life, of your attitude about everything. And so a little salute to mine, whose name was Edna May. So all you teachers out there, thank you very much. I hope you are not ground down, that you are not running out of steam, that you see what it is that we need from you, and you've always been able to give it. So thank you very much. Ruth, as you heard, is a professor of history at New York University and publisher of Lucid, which is a Substack newsletter, which I can recommend to all of you. And as we talk about the role of fear in the decline of democracy, I think there are moments, cultural moments, that we all share. In, for example, the movie Casablanca, I don't know how old you were when you saw it, but it was World War II in a nutshell. The moment the bar patrons stood up against the Nazis, among them singing an anthem of freedom, they had chose courage over fear at that point. And to think almost 250 years ago, the founders of this democracy signing their names to a document which, if they landed on the wrong side, they would never see freedom or perhaps even life again. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. These were individuals who had fortunes, who carried a great deal of weight and put a great deal of faith in the word honor and what it meant. And so for these substantial individuals to put themselves forward, like what they feared, what they overcame, is going to be talked about a lot, I think, in the few weeks we have before the 4th of July. And so let's talk about ourselves in the present moment and what methods and techniques are being used to make us afraid and how people profit from our fear and who these people are. So, Ruth, thank you again for being here. And please, I hope you have a drink of water handy. If not, you can take a minute to get one. Are you good?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, good. Thank you very much. The theme of fear in the decline of a democracy suggests that it's a tool of autocrats, a tool of the tyrannical. How is it used as a tool?
Well, I would start by saying that autocrats are the strong man. The secret of the strong man is that he is ruled by fear. They are fearful and weak individuals who use the autocratic, you know, tools of rule of corruption to buy their allies, to kind of bind their allies to them by paying them off. They use violence, of course, on people to make people afraid to stand up, as you were saying before. And but they do a lot of what they do is because they are ruled by fear. They're always looking over their shoulder. They're obsessed with bunkers, with palaces, with having safe spaces to go to. And we're living through that. That's like check another box. If you've read my book, Strongmen, in the endings chapter, I talk about the bunker stage. And the Washington Post had a investigation recently. They looked at what President Trump had been speaking about the most in the last months, and the most common theme was the ballroom and the bunker. So they're ruled by fear. Because they understand fear, they know how important it is to use fear on others. And so they create enemies, and they use this particular method, which I call survivalism. And so polarization we hear about a lot. And that's when, you know, you're in the same system, you're in a democracy, perhaps, you don't agree. So you don't share the same opinions, but you're in the same system. Survivalism is when you have been indoctrinated and made to fear the other person or the other group as an existential threat. So it's not just me versus you, like with polarization. It's me or you, and only one of us is going to survive. And so throughout history, you have various narratives that aim to make others existential threats, like great replacement theory, the idea that whites are going to be annihilated. Of course, during Nazism and fascist regimes and onward, you have Jews as demonic and they control everything and they're going to, rape our kids. So you have that narrative. Or you have like communists are coming and everything will be broken and ruined. And so that was used in the Cold War to justify coups. So fear is absolutely crucial to the authoritarian playbook. And this is just some of the ways it's been used.
About authoritarians and the fear that you said they have, is this a fear that they acquire once they reach the top? Or is it a kind of imposter syndrome, like I'm not as good or as big or as important or whatever as all these people think I am, and I better protect myself from them finding out? In a way, the emperor's new clothes.
That's such an interesting question. Actually, so it gets worse. The paradox of autocrats is the longer they're in power and the more secure they would seem to be, the more they get worried that someone is going to have a coup, palace coup against them. So they get more fearful, more paranoid, and they start, purging people, right? So, but actually, they're driven by fear from the very beginning because regular politicians, like non-autocrats, if you're under investigation and you have legal problems, you don't want to run for office because journalists will start poking around. That's just, you don't want to do that. But if you're a strongman and you're like, you're worried about whatever legal problems you have, or you're under investigation. You feel compelled by your fear to run for office so you can get into power and fix your problems so no one will be able to get you. And so here's a partial list of the people who have run for office while they're under investigation: Putin, Berlusconi 3 times, Trump 3 times, Netanyahu. So Netanyahu's example where he was under investigation for corruption, that's a very common thing. And then he wanted to get in and do his judicial reform. And the judicial reform, that's the classic, so that then he wouldn't have these problems anymore. He would make them go away. And so there you see that they're ruled by fear at the beginning, and then the longer they stay in power, they get more and more fearful and they get more reckless, both often toward their own people, which is where I said with purges, more violence. They always become more radical and more violent, not less. And then sometimes they start wars if they feel very threatened. Let's say their popularity is tanking, they're starting to lose, their legitimacy. Then often they go to war or they go further into a war they're already in.
Are these responses intuitive, or is there like a secret library of authoritarian, guidebooks that they're reading and consulting, or maybe even one another?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot. It's a very interesting question. I can say that on the one hand, they're watching each other. They learn from each other. This is for sure. So, for example, Mussolini was the first, he was in power, he got to power very quickly. He founded fascism in 1919. 3 years later, he's already prime minister. And just a few years after that, he's a dictator. So Hitler was watching Mussolini intently because we all know that Hitler had some problems getting into office. He had his putsch, it failed, he went to jail. It took him a long time. So he worshipped Mussolini so much that he watched everything he did, and he even had a statue of Mussolini on his desk. And so Trump is always talking about, Putin and Xi. And so they watch each other, they watch what they've been able to get away with, what they can emulate. So there's that. But what I found from my research is that although their circumstances are very different, they're all over the world, some are communists, some are fascists, they do have similar personalities. And one trait is that besides being paranoid, we talked driven by fear, we talked about before, they're transactional. They're completely amoral. And so they're not, they will take advantage of junctures of history or opportunities to do things that other kinds of people wouldn't do. They also have no loyalty to the truth, quite the contrary. So they make themselves into whatever is needed at the moment. And so they'll tell this group, you know, X, and another group, negative X. So they end up with these strange constituencies of housewives and gangsters, priests or religious people, and then the most lawless, depraved people. And so they're able to do that because they are completely transactional.
What has saved us so far in this country from that?
Well, we're not, I mean, you could argue that we're not being saved at all from that.
I don't mean the last 10 years. I mean, say the 240 years preceding that.
I'm not an expert in American history, but we had a respect, and we have, well, the bipartisan system used to be a kind of source of stability. Now it's a problem, actually, if you compare it to the flexibility of multi-party systems. When you have an autocrat, you're trying to beat back. But I think there was a common understanding of certain of that we were lucky to be a democracy. And then later, after the 1960s and onward, we were one of the most stunning examples of a multiracial, multi-faith democracy in the world, with the strongest economy at the end of the Biden years. So there was a kind of common understanding of the rule of law, of the idea of checks and balances, of the principles of the founders. And what strongmen do is, whatever their system they come into at the time, they search for weaknesses in those systems and they exploit them. And they corrupt people with the idea that they can have more power than they ever dreamed to plunder the environment, plunder the workforce, and make money. And so they recruit people who have no, they have no respect for the idea of checks and balances, or the idea of conflicts of interest, or human rights, or rule of law. These are fundamental democratic principles. And what we're seeing, what we're living through now in America, is a completely different, the people who are in power have a completely different mentality, and they simply don't recognize as valid any of those things.
And yet they manage to find their way to the top. And that has to do a lot with the vulnerabilities to some of these tricks, for want of another word, that the population is seeing and responding to. And one of those that you write about extensively is victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, you know, we recognize who real victims are in this country, in this culture. It, for example, is the Black population that has been exploited for 300 years, Native Americans who were wiped out and whose land was taken, women who had no voice in the halls of power for, what, the 170 years of this country's early days. And yet now the idea of who is a victim has been hijacked in a way and completely rewritten by the present administration from the very top, which casts itself as a victim. How did that happen?
Well, this too is a very old playbook. I mean, Mussolini, he talked about the victimhood, his own victimhood, at the hands of corrupt Democrats, and also Italy's
victimhood.
Was
that even true? Or was it true? Or was he just putting his thumb on the scales?
So he was putting his thumb on the scales, and he was a brilliant orator, and he was a journalist by training. And many of the people who have been most savvy about victimhood kind of discourses come from journalism or television, and they understand what is going to provoke an emotional response in people, including fear. And so what they do is that autocrats like they don't recognize any boundary between public and private. So when they're not just representing the nation like in a democratic polity. They are embodying the nation, like literally with their bodies. So their enemies are the nation's enemies. And so they are assuming the burden of victimhood on behalf of the nation. And so Mussolini does this, and Hitler posed as a victim. He actually, when he in the 20s, when he was trying to get to power, there were speaking bans on him in several German states because he was going around doing hate speech. And the Nazi Party was very smart in making political capital of this. And if you have Strongman, you can look. There's a picture of this poster I'm going to describe. And they issued posters of Hitler. In our parlance, it would be that he was canceled with duct tape over his mouth because he was the only person who couldn't speak the truth. He was trying to get the truth out. And because the establishment didn't like his truth, he was imprisoned and he had become a victim. So they use the victimhood thing to appeal to people who don't like the system and they pose as kind of rogues. And so when Trump said I think it was during the 2024 campaign, he said, they're coming after me, but they're really coming after you, and I'm just in the way. And I thought, oh, check another box, because that's, again, they are victims, not only in their own right of witch hunts and, deep state, whatever the parlance of that country is. They also are victims on behalf of the nation. And so that's where they are. You can get into kind of allied religious rhetoric where they're saviors and they're martyrs. They're willing to take risks. And so this is very compelling to people. And because they have previously instilled fear in people with these, could it be great replacement theory or just that the nation is going down the tubes? You're endangered, your security is in danger, your livelihood is in danger, but I will save you. I alone can fix it. But I'm taking risks for you, and I might be a victim, but I'm willing to do it for you. I wanted to unfurl the whole thing because it's incredibly, that's why people bond so tightly. To these guys, where they love them, and it's very hard if they've bonded like this for them to give up their affection.
We will, of course, be asking questions from you that you would like me to put to Ruth on your behalf. If you will put them, please, in the Q&A box, we'll be sorting through them to find them when we start that part of the program in about 15 or 20 minutes. But, the last 100 years or so, this country, again, barring the present administration, has been one with sort of Teddy Roosevelt. We have to keep the rich in check. We have to break up monopolies and cartels, for example. We have to, on occasion, impose very high taxes for a war or for other purposes on rich people. The marginal tax rate in the 1950s, one of the most prosperous decades in America, was up toward the 90 percentile. This is the marginal tax rate above certain other limits and ceilings. And so we've always had a sense that rich people are exploitive, that America was founded with the working man and the middle class man. And it just seems to set all of that on its head that an extremely rich man like Trump can run for office and say, "Oh, poor me, I'm such a victim. They hate me. They hate me because I'm so successful. They're out to get me legally because I'm so successful," when in fact, he had been dodging tax laws and other things back as far as New York for a very long time. So how did America change to buy into this victimhood?
Well, I think it's that Trump was very successful in, first of all, he posed as a successful businessman who would bring, at the very beginning, 2016, I was covering the campaign for CNN Opinion. And he posed as a successful businessman who would bring all of his savvy to save America. And he very smartly appealed to white working class people who were indeed suffering and who Democrats were, you know, largely neglecting. And he said, "You are forgotten no longer. I love you. I'm going to make things better." And he went and visited a couple of factories. And in the meantime, he was setting up grievances and instilling more fear that guess who's taking away your jobs? It's immigrants. Or it's Black people who are getting jobs that you should have. Or look at those women. Why do we need gender equality? And so when he got into power in his first administration, I have this in my book, he appointed a record number of, you know, different kinds of sexist and domestic abusers and all of that. And so he was able to make his richness an asset. But that's because he's one of the most skilled propagandists that of history. He's able to make people. He was able to make tens of millions of people believe that he won the 2020 presidential election, which is a pretty big and verifiable fact, and impose it as a party orthodoxy and a governmental orthodoxy now. That's incredible because he wasn't working with the advantages of Hitler and Mussolini. He didn't have a one-party state and a closed media. He pulled this off with an open state and an open media. So he was able to play it in a way that convinced people because he was able to connect with them emotionally. He's very good at that.
And the fear within the reaches of his administration to challenge that. People have been asked on Capitol Hill at confirmation hearings.
Yes.
Did Trump win the 2020 election? And all they'll say is, you know, Joe Biden was sworn in. That's like being afraid to say that the sun is the center of the solar system.
This is a sign that we are in an authoritarian governmental environment because this is the party orthodoxy. And if you do not parrot the lie, it's very Orwellian, you will not have a place in government. It's that simple. And the fact that all of these people, just go along with the lie, it's also used in the judiciary for, judge appointments. It's across the board. And so we're actually living through a lesson in what the Nazis called Gleichschaltung, coordination, because the lie must be embraced by all areas of government, and they coordinate their action. And so you have to have a talking point, which becomes a dogma. It's not so far from communist dogma. That's the dogma point, the doctrinal orthodoxy. And it's extraordinary how it's continued to be. Now he's back in power. He has the ability to make it something that will either promote your career or ruin your career. And so people choose to lie for him.
To save themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
He also has targeted people so far down the social and economic scale from him that you would think it would be that he'd go after people who have power, not as much as he has or thinks he has, but people who are virtually powerless. You think of the two Georgia election workers who were sharing a mint, a mother and a daughter. And this has turned into an election scandal of fake voting, of voting cheating, that they were passing some kind of electronic device to screw the election. How on earth do you find people like that to single it out? And it's not just those women. It's over and over. It's some person maybe working in a library or some small town politician. Who suddenly comes to the notice of Trump, and Trump says, "All right, I'm going to show this guy." Is this simply like making an example of one person to have everybody else at that level in society be fearful?
Yes, it's on the one hand, you make an example of one to instill fear in others, and it's used across the board. But in classic one-party states, whether they're communist or fascist or whatever, the targeting should also seem slightly random. in that you never know when your turn's going to come. You never know what's going to set them off, what social media post, what action, what book you read to your kids. And so regimes, because this is about fear, regimes depend, they do everything possible to make you self-censor. Because when we self-censor, we're doing the regime's job for them, right? We're making it easy because we just decide it's not worth it. And so that's why they keep doing things like this. And however, you can, there is a logic to it. Like I was named in, when Trump sued CNN in 2022 for supposedly comparing him to Hitler. I one of my op-eds was named in the suit, so I'm in the legal complaint. The only person who's not a full-time of the journalist type people, the only person who's not a full-time CNN employee. And the of all the 1,200 op-eds that CNN published a year, mine was singled out because it was an expose of his propaganda methods. And it broke down his pattern of lying. So the 30,000 documented lies that the Washington Post estimated he told, the 30,000 lies prepared people for the big lie. And what he also did is make the stakes go up for not believing the lie, or for countering the lie, or for exposing the way the lies work, which was my approach. And so I found myself in that way targeted. So you never know when your turn will come. And that is supposed to instill you with sufficient fear so that you stop writing or stop speaking. It didn't work on me. And a judge threw out the case, a Trump-appointed judge threw out the case. And then he tried to revive it, and another judge threw it out, saying it was baseless.
But his point wasn't necessarily winning at trial. It was dragging you through a process that was expensive and a little frightening.
Yes, it's the performative dimension of that. And that other people see that you are being targeted so that they're not, they don't want to, they're going to change their behavior and change their speech. So fear, fear is used in myriad ways, and that's just one of them. Another point I wanted to make is that autocrats, and Trump has done this, they twin fear with other emotions that are very strong. There's a lot of neuroscience research showing that fear and disgust are among the emotions that are stay with people the longest. They stay in the brain. They stay there. They're very, very powerful emotions. And so if you think about the history of propaganda and how autocrats target their victims by comparing them to insects. So that what Hitler did with the Jews, for example, that called them parasites or leeches. And then the cockroaches of Rwanda. And then Trump called people vermin, right? Or he said that immigrants were eating cats and dogs, which is designed to evoke disgust. And so these are things that recur throughout history, and they're used over and over because they're very effective. And so again, fear is already very strong, but when you twin fear with disgust or with hatred, then you can move people. You can make people more likely to move to action if you ask them to do violence or approve of violence.
In World Wars One and Two, we waged propaganda campaigns which dehumanized the enemy without question. I have lots of posters of just what you were describing as part of the wartime propaganda. But Trump has used these techniques against Americans. There is no Democrat
yes.
who is even worth working with in his world. And even Republicans who disagree by the smallest of degrees with his policy are subject to his wrath. And as we saw last night, lost their re-elections, their primary re-election campaigns in Louisiana and in Kentucky for telling him no once in a while and saying it rather loudly.
Yeah, so here, this brings up another. So that is him policing others to keep his personality cult, his sense of omnipotence, his sense of infallibility. So these cults have to be maintained. They're like, I always compare them to plants. If you don't water your plant, it dies. So they have to be maintained through fear, through personal attacks. And then one technique that autocrats love is ritual humiliation. If somebody's getting out of line, they're showing a little independence, they haul them on stage, or nowadays on TV, Trump's done this many times, and the person is ritually humiliated. Or you could be Pinochet and Mobutu, and they used to have rallies, and then they would fire people suddenly on camera.
Sounds familiar.
Or in the first administration, you know, people would be fired, learned by looking at Twitter that they'd been fired. So these are all ways that autocrats keep people in line. So they use corruption to keep people in line by buying them off. We're seeing this now with the slush fund that he just created. And then they use fear and targeting people. And by the way, in a kind of classic regime, and including those today, they don't just go after you, they go after your family. So they're real amateur or professional psychologists. They know what is, they study what's going to get to you. And so they threaten your kids. Or if you've left the country and you've gone into exile, they will you know, expropriate the property of your family who's left behind. So they know how to get to you. They know how to instill fear in an ever widening circle. So it's not enough to have you, it has to be others.
And something very medieval, where they used to hold the children of their enemies hostage.
Yes. So that's, we don't talk about that enough, how families are targeted. And this happens all over the world today. Putin does it. Erdogan does it. And it's very effective at getting people. Some people will not stop their resistance no matter what. Other people decide that it's not worth it. And either they're physically threatening with violence, and this happened in our country, or they in the Eastern European communist regimes, they would tell you your child has no future, because when everything is run by the state, and for example, if all educational, higher education is state, your child's not going to be able to go to college, so they become a pariah. And all of this is, we're drilling down in a useful way to the different ways that fear and conformism can be instilled in people.
Just by watching the consequences of opposition, as people saw in the streets in Los Angeles, in Portland, and certainly, you know, in Minnesota. My goodness, those people are just heroic. We see families of people who are vulnerable because of their immigration status threatened. Well, you know, if you want to have your kid with you, you're going to sign this document, or we'll deport you and leave your kid behind, which has happened now, as we have documented in thousands of cases of ICE essentially creating child abandonment when it takes people out of the country and leaves their minor children behind. That family is an incredibly powerful threat. And this administration has not been reluctant, for a family values administration, to carry out these kinds of separations and hardships, dying children left behind in some cases.
And this is because they dehumanize those who are not white. Really, the trajectory we're on, and one of my most recent pieces in Lucid is about that. It's just coming together in a holistic way now with policy. They want to destroy our multiracial democracy and create a white Christian nationalist ethnostate. And every regime has like a central ideological plank, and that's what this one has. And so they have decided to, you know, dehumanize immigrants and non-white immigrants, because I read recently that they're going to be accepting thousands of white South Africans because they're the okay immigrants. And so this is what's going on. And so they don't see these people as deserving to be families. When you're dehumanizing someone, you're not caring about their family or the hardship they suffer. And we're 10 years into this. Trump has been re-educating people to put aside empathy and kindness and love. And I have a whole list of all of his quotes from 2015 on at rallies where he said, "The problem is we don't hurt each other enough anymore. You know, we're too soft." And so now he's got, you know, ICE and other government agencies that have been indoctrinated to think that only some people are deserving of families. Others can just, if their kids have no mother and they're abandoned, they become orphans, who cares? And that's typical of autocracies, because autocracies work because you inculcate fanaticism. And that's what we have now in the ranks of Customs and Border Patrol and ICE and Department of Justice and Stephen Miller's. These are fanatics.
And yet our concept as Americans, and my family has been here since the 1630s, concept of this country is of a generous-spirited one, of an open-minded one that has kind of rational common sense. And if it hears nonsense, it says, "I don't think so." And yet it seems to have bought wholly into this. Where are we now, do you think, in terms of resistance to this? Have we overcome our own fears by seeing that activities with all of us taking part can have good consequences?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that. So on the one hand, if we compare the first, let's say we're getting to a year and a half of this nightmare, the first year and a half of Trump with Putin and Erdogan and Orban, what has gone on here? The toll, the speed, the pace, especially the speed and the scope of the wreckage of institutions, of agencies, of lives, doesn't have a comparison in the first year of autocrats who came to power via election. Some of it, the total wrecking of U.S. science, medicine, public health, it resembles more after a coup or a revolution. So there's that. But if you also look at the first year or so of how people have reacted when autocrats come to power via elections, in terms of resistance, civil resistance, we're doing well. Now, America's a huge country, and this is a bit of a liability. And today, resistance is decentralized often. So we can see, you know, on our screens, everybody coming to the capital of Georgia or everybody coming to the capital of Poland. And we've had those in the past. We had the Women's March. But as you see today, resistance is decentralized. And what's important, though, is that every time we've had a hands-off or a No Kings demonstration, the numbers are rising. And this is incredible. The spontaneous mobilization of networks of assistance in the Twin Cities, in LA, in Chicago, all over, wherever there's been ICE brutalities, the resoluteness and the complexity of those arrangements, given that this are kind of militarized occupation and lawless people who are shooting people execution style. The fact that that's going on and people are signing up by the thousands for trainings, we're kind of ahead of the curve of many other countries. So it can seem like we're not doing enough, but we're actually doing okay if you look comparatively.
It's funny you mentioned geography because my European friends are always saying, well, why don't you all get together and protest? And say, look, we are, and you've been in little towns. And unlike France or unlike London, where you can be, after 2 or 3 hours, you can get to the nation's capital and essentially do a day trip to go protest something. You can't do that in this country. And so the significance is in the local responses, the regional responses, especially in states where you wouldn't expect to find them, which I think is a kind of barometer of how less fearful and how more offended we are.
Yes, and we've also had an extremely robust legal resistance. And the goal in some of these legal actions is to of course, ideally reverse lawless measures, but also to slow down the action of the regime. Because when you slow it down, you save lives, you buy time. And so that's been very effective, considering we're just at the beginning of this and how fast they have moved. And they were able to move fast because of Project 2025, but also because of this fanaticism. There are people like Miller who and Hegseth, who's a holy warrior, and his slogan forever will be for me. He said, "We negotiate with bombs." So this is a good example of fanaticism. This is what fascists say. They're not interested. They don't use their words. I'm a mom, right? You use your words. You tell your kids, "No, we negotiate with bombs. We violence is our language." So these are the kind of people we have here. And so the fact that we've been able to have a legal resistance that has pushed back against the institutions is also something to feel proud of.
Before we get to questions, and there are a great many coming in, how do you think Americans individually are dealing with fear? Because this moment is a very clarifying one. Which side are you on is the way the old Woody Guthrie song, I think, goes. And it's like watching Casablanca or World War II movies. What would I do? Would I be brave? Would I have the courage? And because a great deal is at stake, like the founders now, lives, fortunes, and sacred honor are at stake now for each of us.
Yeah, so I just got a contract to write a book on resistance. The provisional title is Resisting Autocracy. And one of the themes is going to be that there are many, many ways to resist. And not everybody has to be in the streets. There are many ways that you can show your conviction to help others. You can do this behind the scenes. You can do this in communities. You can join boycotts. There's many ways to resist. But many people are detaching now, and this is also wrapped up in a kind of great fatigue with the digital space. People are tired of scrolling, and so they're detaching both because of that, because of how the news is delivered to them, whether it's good or bad. And also a kind of a certain some in some people a fatalism, which I really try and fight against. Oh well, the elections, it doesn't matter to vote. I'm not going to vote because it's all going to be rigged anyway. They're going to do something. Trump's going to do something. And we never ever give up on elections ever. Other countries, they don't give up on elections. And so there is a tendency to feel exhausted, of course. And you know what the civil rights leaders used to say is that if you can't take it, you take a rest for a few days, you restore yourself, and then you come back. So that is also valid in our age. Do a digital detox for 2 days and then come back. But I think it's incumbent upon us, if we're in America, to do what we can to talk to others. Everybody has somebody in their family who is the polite way would be dwelling in the disinformation tunnel. And those people are actually starting to wake up, some of those people, because the economy is crashing, in certain areas because of the tariffs. the signs of malfeasance and malgovernance are becoming harder to ignore. And so this is a good time. That's also resistance work to try and change minds, reach hearts. So again, I would just say that there are many ways to do this. Protest is just one of them.
The phrase I keep hearing is no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. So let's get some
yes.
questions. I have one from, let's see, where did you go, good sir? It was Edward here we are, Edward in Morristown, New Jersey. Why is the Democratic Party, the DCC, and the Democratic Governors Association so afraid to confront all the issues surrounding Trump's cruel and illegal immigration policy? He says, I get opinion surveys from those groups offering checklists of urgent issues to be prioritized. None of them lists ICE raids, illegal arrests, and detentions without due process or mass deportation. Why are Democrats so afraid to speak out?
I mean, I don't think all of them are. I think certainly the mayors of cities that have been targeted by ICE occupations have been speaking out for a long time, and continue to speak out even when the occupation is, slightly reduced.
But the
so
level
I,
you're talking about, the federal officials.
Yeah, I think that the Democratic Party we have a situation where people don't know what to tackle first. And the Democratic Party is historically not so great with messaging. And here I want to say, this is, if you look comparatively, it is difficult with such a giant party that has all these different types of people to have the kind of messaging discipline. And this is a good thing in terms of it's not Trump and the Republicans where we went over how you have to parrot the party line or else. The Democrats are not like that. So what you lose, though, is that some people are very strong messengers on exactly those issues. They're going to ICE facilities. But you're right that it doesn't make its way to the top, and it's not presented as a, I've been arguing that we have to present this as a moral emergency. This is about decency. This is about justice. And it's been very difficult to get the leadership to cohere around these talking points.
Let's see. Here's a fear-related question. Nessa wants to know what explains the attacks on the CDC vaccines and medical research. Why would a Trump administration want to create fear around scientific advances that have made Americans healthier, safer, along with the world, for that matter, for more than 50 years?
That's a great question. Two things. One is this is an administration, and the people, the experts in it on this area have been doing this for years. They traffic in conspiracy theories that they want to destroy the truth. They're afraid of the truth. They're afraid of the idea of objective facts and fact-based mentality. They prefer you to be swept up in, well, maybe uncertainty, conspiracy theories, because then you start to doubt yourself. And so there's been an attack across the board at the idea of objective truth. And that's why they go after educators, and science is one of the most tragic aspects of this. So that's part of it. However, I think there's another, I have to say, to tell everybody that it's very unusual for an autocracy to destroy science so quickly, especially when it's a country like the United States, which contributed hugely to scientific research, and it was a whole part of its prestige and intellectual capital and making life better for people abroad. Very unusual. Often what happens, like people know about the Nazis, science gets rerouted to whatever the ideological priorities are of the government. So racial science, So they didn't wreck science in Nazi Germany. They rerouted it. And the same with the Soviets, and they privileged, they put dissidents in psychiatric institutions. They changed psychiatry. Here, it's just being wrecked, right? Public health is being wrecked. I actually think that Trump would lie. He wants to make people, he wants to wreck the country. I mean, he's a Putin asset. He's a Putin partner. And his job, and I've said this since January 2025, is to thoroughly and holistically wreck America so that it will take generations to come back, because that way autocracies can prosper. And so wrecking science, making people diseased, wrecking everything that gave us prestige in the world and made us healthy and gave us well-being, that has to be among the first things to go. I understand this is very bleak. Tim Snyder is talking about superpower suicide. I actually am going to have a discussion with him about this. I think it's superpower murder, because we're not choosing to wreck our own scientific establishment. It's Trump and company who are doing it. So that's more like a murder.
Well, I've always characterized this administration as embarking on a murder-suicide pact. So both of you can be right.
It's both. Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah,
nobody
we'll
wants to
have,
be.
that's a good formulation for us when we have our discussion.
Trump said, or Teresa says, what does the fear that Trump has generated through his propaganda and manipulation, when, excuse me, when does it turn to anger? I would argue that it already has.
Yeah.
Now, has he been able to control it, to manage it? Or does at some point it get out of hand? I mean, there's certainly we've seen dictators create mobs that destroy the dictators, and this may be no exception.
Yeah, so part of what that is the tr that is a trajectory, and people get so there's a lot of new, because we're in a renaissance of protest around the world, mostly nonviolent. There's a lot of research now about what leads people to take to the streets or resist in ways that end up weakening the dictator. And one of the big things is corruption. When they are blatantly corrupt and they're thumbing their nose at you, and remember that our taxpayer dollar in an autocracy, you're actually paying to be repressed. It's your taxpayer dollars that pay for the brutality. These are public servants, right? So people get so that and the corruption they don't like. And then economic hardship, because you see that the rich are getting far richer and you're having problems. They're trying to take your benefits away. And so all of this creates anger, which translates both into mass protest and also into electoral victories, if elections are still working, which in most of the places they still are. We saw that in Hungary. People were pissed off in Hungary. The country had become one of the most impoverished in Europe. And Orban and company, and it's not just him and his friends, it's his family, it's clans. With the same thing happening here, they were all billionaires. And so people were angry, and they channeled that anger into their votes. And lo and behold, Orban is gone.
And yet now we have a so-called slush fund that may make millionaires out of some of the people who tried to overthrow the government in the January 6th coup, which surely is good
Yes.
for some discussion among ordinary Americans.
Yeah, we have to. This is a messaging. This is messaging gold. And I've always talked about January 6th, it broke the party. It broke the GOP, because he sent a violent mob to attack Republicans as well as Democrats. Republicans were calling their loved ones to say, I don't think I'm ever going to see you again. And then they were required to forget their trauma of that day and praise their attackers as patriots. And now they're required to say it's great that their attackers are going to be paid back for attacking them. So this is what I mean by breaking the party, but we have to message this. And it's our tax dollars that are being, this is how kleptocracy works. Your tax dollars are rerouted and directed into the pet projects of the leader, as well as into their offshore bank accounts.
Is holding office so important to them that they will knuckle under to Trump with his threats? Or we've seen them
Apparently,
quit. We have.
some of them have quit, but here's the fear again. Trump has collected information on people, in that he's like his patron Putin, who did this
Edgar
professionally.
Hoover.
Yes, there are people who do the intelligence work who do this professionally. But Trump has done this since the 1980s. He's always collected dirt on people. And his mentors were Roger Stone and Roy Cohn. Roger Stone is still around, right? And Roger Stone worked for a number of dictators and did things like that for them. So these are experts. They've been doing this a long time. So Trump both threatens to end their careers. They tell them they'll be primaried, they'll lose their congressional seats. But there's a lot of threat that goes on. And we know this because starting in 2019, during the impeachment, there were Republicans who voted to impeach him, and they had to buy body armor because people were threatening their families. So then we go back to the family, right? So it's, yeah.
Yeah, I have to interrupt because we need one minute, one hopeful minute, one
Oh,
positive minute from you.
yes. So I actually see, I think that Orban's fall is these guys are aging out, with a few exceptions like Bukele. They are, authoritarianism is not sustainable. It is too corrupt. And there's something called autocratic backfire. I think they're all on their way out. And we have to stay the course. We have to message to other people. We have to do civic education. We have to protest. We have to vote in huge numbers to compensate for voter repression. And my slogan is never underestimate the American people.
Ruth, so happy to have you back and look forward to you again when you have your new book out and would like to talk about that. Always a pleasure. We thank you so much. We
Thank you.
thank all of you for joining us as well. You can see upcoming programs right there. We hope you'll be joining us for that and supporting these important hours in our nation's civic life. My name is Pat Morrison, and I thank you all for joining us on behalf of the team that makes this possible.